Thank you very much for invitation and to Rob. It's a great conference. So I will speak about putting Gaussian measures on the space of all Riemannian metrics, and then using this Gaussian measure to study some fairly simple-minded questions about curvature, Gauss curvature in dimension 2, scalar curvature in higher dimensions, Q curvature in higher even dimensions, and then I'll define what it is. And then I think the techniques could be useful for other problems, but so I'll try to convince people. So this is joint work with Igor Wigman, who, oh, he used to be at KTH, but now he's at Cardiff. And my student, Chaita Kanzani. So just some, we should always work on compact manifolds, and let's assume that they are orientable. So then I'll half the room knows these things much better than I do, so we have some Riemannian metric, and then we have Riemann curvature tensor, and then Ricci. And then scalar curvature is the sort of volume defect of a little ball around some point compared with Euclidean ball. And so then, of course, if we, from geometry, we know that if we make some assumptions about the sine of curvature or some bounds on curvature, then lots of very interesting results follow, and I guess at this conference, kind of, so Alexandrov-type assumptions involve maybe lower bounds for sectional curvature, and then if you have lower bounds for Ricci curvature, then you have also some very nice results. So I will be trying to to answer in some restricted setting the following question. So what is, so I'll define what a random metric is. Our random metrics would be in a conformal class. So kind of not all metrics, but a large chunk of them. And then what is the probability that a given metric would satisfy a certain curvature bounds? So in some sense, you know, what is the probability that assumptions in your favorite theorem hold? Right? So I'll mostly speak about scalar curvature and then also about Q curvature. So first we shall use Laplacian to define random metrics in a conformal class. The main question is we shall always have some reference metric. And then we shall make a random conformal change. And then, for the reference metric, we shall assume that, let's say, scalar curvature has constant sign. And then the question will be, what is the probability that after a random conformal change somewhere on the manifold, on the compact manifold, the curvature will change sign? So that will be sort of a model question, which I will be asking. So this is sort of studying the geometry of the space of all metrics where curvature has constant sign. Scalar curvature. We'll use Laplacian to define random metrics and study scalar curvature, and then we shall play a very similar game, except that we shall use conformally covariant operators to study Q curvature. And I will define what this all means. Techniques. The way of defining random metrics. It's fairly common, so for metrics, I think it comes from conformal field theory, although my metrics are smooth, kind of continuously differentiable, my metrics are smoother than the metrics you get, let's say, in quantum gravity or in conformal field theory, typically. Differential geometry and spectral theory of elliptic operators. And then, to answer this question about curvature changing sign, the techniques from probability are about excursion sets, large excursion sets of Gaussian random fields. And the kind of a very general result are due to Borel and Thurlson, Ibragimov, Subakov, and then slightly more precise recent results with more restrictive assumptions on random fields are due to Adler and Taylor. So that's the kind of things we should be using. So I'll say that I'll expand a bit on the question. So we choose some reference metric, let's say a round metric on the sphere, or you know, metric of constant negative curvature on some surface of genus 2 or more. And then we define, we put Gaussian measure in the space of all metrics in lying in the conformal class of this guy. And in a regime where we can get good estimates, our measure will be fairly concentrated, will be concentrated fairly close to the initial metric. So we assume that scalar curvature has constant sign, so do such things exist? In dimension 2, there is a uniformization theorem which tells that in every conformal class, there exists a unique metric of constant Gauss curvature, scalar curvature. It's the same. The curvature on the sphere, on the sphere there is just one conformal class up to diffeomorphisms. So the metric is the round metric. On the torus, the metric is flat, but we shall not look at the torus because the curvature, by Gauss-Bonnet theorem, curvature integrates to zero, so it has to change sign, or it's identically zero. So torus will be excluded. But if genus is two or above, then in every conformal class there exists a unique metric of constant Gauss curvature. And then, in higher dimensions, you can ask the same question about scalar curvature. Do we have metrics of constant scalar curvature? This is known as Yamabe problem, right? And this was solved by, well, this was started by Yamabe, and then Trudinger, Aubin, Rickshain, proved that in every conformal class, there exist metrics, possibly more than one, of constant scalar curvature. And the sign is uniquely determined. If the scalar curvature is non-positive, then this metric is unique. And then, recently in the Gauss curvature and scalar curvature has been around for a long time. Q curvature has been around for much less, but this is a sort of a useful thing which comes up if you work in conformal geometry. So I'll give a definition on some examples. So what is nice is that you can prove some sort of some analog of Yamabe problem or of uniformization theorem has been solved for Q curvature. You can ask, you know, is it true that in every conformal class there exists a metric with constant Q curvature? Q curvature is a function on a manifold which can be either constant or not. And so in dimension 4, first of all, under some additional assumptions, Cheng and Yang proved that in every conformal class which satisfies those assumptions, there exists a metric of constant Q curvature. And then to remove these assumptions took some time. So in dimension 4, it was shown by Judley and Malchiotti, I think it appeared in 2008, that there exists a metric of constant Q curvature for generic conformal classes. And then an arbitrary dimension, Diaya, who is a student of Malchiotti, extended this result, at least in even dimensions. I don't understand these things so well in odd dimensions. So Spiros in this department knows these things probably better than me, and so I will, about Q curvature, I'll restrict myself to even dimensions. Okay, so what do I mean by a random metric? If we have a compact manifold, we start with some reference metric, which we'll assume to be smooth, and so there exists a Laplacian. Manifold is compact, so it's you can choose a basis of L2 which will consist of eigenfunctions of this Laplacian. So constant function will have eigenvalue zero, and then if the manifold is connected, all other eigenvalues will be strictly positive, and they will increase. And you can count how many eigenvalues you have less than some number. This is called Weyl's law. And you know, an example: take a circle. Eigenfunctions are sines and cosines, and then any function in L2 you can expand in a series of these eigenfunctions, which we call Fourier series. Right. So if you take a more general manifold, then instead of Fourier series, it's convenient to use eigenfunctions of Laplacian, and you can expand the whole thing. Okay. So then, if you have a metric in a conformal class, then suppose G naught would be a reference metric, and so a general metric in a conformal class will be the reference metric times some positive function, which will depend on a point. Right, so all entries of Gij will be multiplied by the same positive number, but the number may be different from one point to another. And I would like to write a positive function as a sum of random Fourier series. And so if I do it directly, then it's difficult to keep it positive. So I cheat, I write it as an exponential. E to the f of x, where the function f of x doesn't have to be positive anymore. And so that function f of x, I make a random combination of eigenfunctions of Laplacian. So I make it into a random Fourier series. And let's see. And the coefficients we choose to be Gaussian, but if we choose all the coefficients to be IID standard Gaussians, then the series will not converge. Because let's think about usual Fourier series. If you look at a Fourier series on a circle where the function is differentiable k times, then the Fourier coefficients have to decay as n Fourier coefficient is less than some constant divided by n to the power k. Right? Yeah, well, on the other hand, you know, if the coefficients decay like that, then the function will be differentiable, but with some loss of derivatives. So now let's, the same type result, the same type of results hold for random Fourier series, for random series of eigenfunctions of Laplacian, except that they hold almost surely. So if you want the sum of your random Fourier series to be move almost surely, then your Fourier coefficients, if you choose coefficients to be Gaussian, then the variance has to decay as the eigenvalue is growing. And the faster it decays, the smoother the sum of random Fourier series will be. So kind of the same intuition which applies to non-random Fourier series also holds for random. So we shall assume that, so we have standard Gaussian, which I call AJ, and they are multiplied by, sum f of x would be a sum over all eigenvalues lambda j positive. In my Fourier series, I do not include a constant function because that is just rescaling my metric by the same positive factor at all points. And so that doesn't give me any new information. So I'm just increasing all the lengths by a factor of 10. I've done nothing. So constant function is excluded. And then, I have phi j of x. So that's the Fourier series of the function f of x. I put AJs are IID standard Gaussian. And then I multiply them by some coefficients, Cj, which, it's less than some constant divided by lambda j to some power. Eventually. So at least if j is large enough, then this should be true. And how large should be this power f, I will say in a few seconds. And then, so Well, so you have a Gaussian random field on your manifold, just a scalar Gaussian function, and you can define the covariance function, which is just an expectation of, it depends on two points on the manifold, so it's a product, expectation of a product of f of x and f of y, and this guy is not random anymore because we have integrated out all the coefficients, and so this is just a, it looks a bit like a spectral function for the Laplacian, and so cj squared. So if cj is something like lambda j to the minus s, that would be a spectral function for, it would be a zeta function of the Laplace operator. So, you know, make cj, if we're in a circle, and if we make cj decay polynomially, that would be a Riemann zeta function, for example, because sine squared plus cos squared, every point is equal to 1. So on the circle, we'll recover Riemann zeta function. Okay. This guy has analytic continuation and is kind of well understood. And then, well, we can take two points on the manifold to be the same, so we can look at the diagonal on in manifold cross itself, and then we'll just have the sum of cj squared and then the square of the jth eigenfunction. And eigenfunctions we maybe normalize to have L2 norm 1. Just fine. Okay. So then also it will be convenient to look at the Laplacian applied. So we have a reference metric, and there is a Laplacian for the reference metric, and it will be, we shall need to look at the Laplacian applied to this random Fourier series. And so Fourier expansions, it's a great pleasure to apply Laplacian term by term. If the Fourier coefficients decay fast enough, then you can do it. And then, okay, so the nth term, it gets just multiplied by lambda j. And if we look at the covariance function, the coefficient in front of cj is multiplied by lambda j squared. Okay, and then, so you can show that if sum cj squared 1 plus lambda j to the s is finite, then f is in the s, I think, Sobolev space almost surely. If you have a random Fourier series, well, a good reference, you know, is maybe a book by Jean-Pierre Cahan, Random Series of Functions, and so all these things and much, much more is discussed there. So if you have a random Gaussian Fourier series, then you can write down the expectation of a Sobolev norm of this function, and so if this thing is finite, then you will have that. And then, well, if f is in Sobolev space with large enough s, then by Sobolev embedding theorem, it will be differentiable sufficiently many times. So that's how we can show this proposition, which is actually due to David Bleeker, who considered a similar problem a while ago, that so if the coefficients decay, faster than polynomially, where the power is bigger than dimension over 2, then the function is almost surely continuous, and if f is 1 higher, then f is almost surely C2, and Laplacian f is continuous, and so on. And now, now we do the following thing. We take the logarithm of f is the logarithm of conformal multiple, and so we take this function f and multiply it by some positive constant a, and we make this positive constant a go to 0. So a will be going to 0. So that sort of means that all the Gaussian coefficients are becoming smaller as it goes to 0. They're peaking around 0. So when we take an exponential, that means that exponential is very becoming more and more peaked around 1. And that means that the random metric is getting closer and closer to the reference metric G0. And that's the regime in which we shall be able to estimate some probability well. So, you know, you lost your wallet and you look under the street light because that's where you can see best. It's a little bit like that, but this is the regime in which we can estimate things best. But at least there is an advantage that if you multiply by this factor, then you do not preserve the volume, right? So volume is not preserved under this under such a conformal deformation. But if A is going to zero, then of course in the limit A goes to zero, the volume is preserved, or at least it's, and if A is small enough, it's almost surely bounded above and below. Yes. Right. Well, we'll find something. So, let me tell you what we shall find. So we want to study scalar curvature, and the reason we can do anything is that under a conformal transformation, so suppose you have the new metric which we call G1, then let's call the scalar curvature R1 of X, and the old scalar curvature was R0 of X. So then there is a nice formula which gives you in closed form how the new scalar curvature is related to the old one. So that's quite useful. So here is the formula. It's the reciprocal of the conformal multiple times the old scalar curvature times, well, A, since I was putting A in front, N minus 1 applied times the Laplacian the background metric Laplacian applied to this random function f minus the gradient minus another thing times gradient f squared. And in dimension 2, the coefficient in front of gradient f squared vanishes, right? Because we have a multiple of n minus 2. So then the formula in two dimensions becomes much easier. So there is no gradient squared term. So you have, so H is, you know, it's Laplacian of F, so this is the random guy. R0 is the old scalar curvature, is the deterministic guy. And then you look at this thing. And if the coefficients decay fast enough, then almost surely, and the old curvature is smooth enough, then almost surely the new guy would be continuous or differentiable, however many times you need it to be differentiable. Okay. So let's remember what the problem is. The problem is we start, all these things depend on a point. And for the starting metric, this guy had constant sign, right? And we're looking at the sign of the new guy. The conformal multiple is a positive number, so it doesn't change the sign. So the sign of the new scalar curvature is equal to the sign of the old scalar curvature times the sign of this expression. So we can take 1 minus A times, you know, Laplacian F divided by the old scalar curvature. So in some sense, AH divided by this old guy, scalar curvature are not, sometimes we can think of it as a random wave. And random wave is just a random linear, is just random Fourier series with random coefficients. And so this is just a manifold version of Fourier series with random coefficients. So sometimes this thing is called a random wave. Okay. Let's see. So now the question is, so we'll look at the expression 1 minus A times Laplacian F divided by R0. And the question is, when is this quantity negative? And, well, that, of course, happens. Yeah, in two dimensions, and then, so let's fix dimension two, because then there is no gradient square term, and we'll come back to that. So I'm looking at, I'm asking, when is this guy greater than 1 over A? And remember, A is going to 0. So the probability that the scalar curvature will change sign under a random perturbation is equal to the probability that this Laplacian divided by the old scalar curvature, the supremum on a manifold, will be bigger than 1 over A. And 1 over A is increasing as A goes to 0. So then, well, okay, so let's look at the new random variable, Laplacian F divided by the old scalar curvature. The covariance would be the covariance for Laplacian F, which we wrote down, times the scalar curvature, times the product of the old scalar curvatures at x and y. And since the old scalar curvature was different from 0, we are not dividing by 0. So this makes sense. And now, okay, so we are asking, what is the probability that somewhere on the manifold, this Gaussian random field will take a value which is bigger than 1 over A in the limit, in the regime as 1 over A goes to infinity. So this is a excursion probability of Gaussian random field. What do we know? So it follows, let's call the probability that the curvature will change sign, let's call this probability P2, which will depend on this number A. And of course, since the, since you are saying, like you were saying, since we're looking at the street light, since A is going to 0, the probability that it will change sign will go to 0. So we shall find something, but very little. Okay, it's a continuous problem. So we know the probability that Gaussian random field will take a value bigger than 1 over A will decay exponentially. Will decay like so this probability by Borel TIS theorem, Trilson, Brigham, Sudakov, will if so the scalar curvature, the resulting random field has to be almost surely bounded. So if it's almost surely continuous, we're okay. We can apply this result. And then it will follow that, so there is some constant, some number, that this probability is at most constant divided by A minus, well, the usual minus 1 over, you know, A squared, so it's the usual Gaussian decay, times 2A squared times sigma V squared. And this this constant is the, so let's see, so sigma V squared is just the supremum over X on the manifold well, let me just write it out, sum of the squares of coefficients lambda j squared phi j of x squared divided by the square of the old scalar curvature. So this is a positive function, at least non-negative. So some manifold is compact, somewhere it takes a maximal value. So it's a point where this Gaussian field has largest variance, maximal variance. In the limit, if the height, or you know, you're trying to jump over a plank, and the height of the plank goes to infinity, the probability that you jump anywhere over this plank is very well approximated that you do it at a point where your field has largest variance. But if you look at realization of your field at that point, that's just a standard Gaussian on the real line with a variance sigma v squared, and that probability is just a Gaussian integral. So that gives you a good approximation. So probability is estimated from above by Borel TIS, and from below, well, the probability that the supremum is greater than 1 over a somewhere in the manifold is at least probability that it's greater than this number at a point with the largest variance. So that way you can get a two-sided estimate. So the probability that the curvature will change sign is bounded from above and from below by factors, you know, who the behavior at infinity is really Gaussian, and then you have slightly different prefactors, but well, you have the usual large deviation estimate from for this. So if you multiply this take logarithm of this probability and multiply by a squared and take a limit as a goes to zero, then it will be the limit will be minus one over the twice the largest variance. Okay, so this is the guy. Okay, so the curvature will change sign with a probability that is going to zero, and we know the rate, so we can estimate from above and below. Okay. Now let's make a choice. Let's choose. So we get this variance like this, and then the question is: okay, so we can we, for some concrete choice of coefficients, can we estimate this number? How big is it? How small is it? So, well, let's do a model problem. So let's make the Fourier coefficients decay exponentially. Okay, so they have to decay at least polynomially, but let's make them decay exponentially. That means that we are looking at kind of random real analytic Fourier series. So we make the Fourier coefficient Cj, let's see, here. It decays like e to the minus eigenvalue over t over 2, and well, we divide by lambda j just for convenience, and so t over 2 is maybe something like a radius of analyticity or something like this. How fast the exponential rate of the exponent and the exponential rate of decay. All right, so let's look at this. Let's look then at this sigma v squared. It's the supremum over x of what? Well, sum e to the minus lambda j t over all positive eigenvalues lambda j, phi j of x squared divided by the square of the old scalar curvature. So this is just the heat kernel for the all Laplacian of a reference metric without the constant term, right? Because the constant function doesn't participate in Fourier expansion. Even if it did, when we take the Laplacian, it disappears. And then, okay, so that now we have one parameter here, which is t. So it's the time of the heat kernel. So, well, what do we know about heat equation of the manifold? Well, every manifold at a very small scale is flat, approximately. So the heat kernel for very small in the limit as time goes to zero looks like heat kernel in Rn. N is dimension of a manifold. And so the it follows that this guy, so the heat kernel, the expression upstairs decays the limiting behavior to first order doesn't depend on a point x where we're computing the heat kernel, and it goes to zero like if we normalize correctly, like 1 over 4 pi t to the power dimension over 2. And so the point where but then we have to remember that we're dividing by the square of the old scalar curvature, right? So this expression will be as large as possible if scalar curvature squared is as small as possible. So we have to look at the infimum of the old scalar curvature. So a point where you're where the curvature of random metric is most likely to change sign in this regime is a point where the old scalar curvature is the smallest. So this is kind of the weakest link in the chain. Okay, so that's not very surprising, but we know the rate at which it happens. All right. So then we can prove sort of a nice we can prove a comparison result. So we start with a we can start with two reference metrics where curvature would have constant sign. And then for each metric, we can compute the probability that after a random conformal perturbation, sign will change. Let's compare these two numbers. So we get a number. Let's compare these two numbers. And then, so the result is that if you have two different reference metrics, and for one metric, curvature is identically constant, for the other it is not. Then, our regime is, you know, so we have two numbers. We have A, which is the multiple in front of the random Fourier series, and T, so it's the time, you know, in the heat kernel. So if both of them are small enough, then the probability that curvature will change sign for metric for the constant scalar curvature metric is strictly less than the probability that will change sign for a metric where scalar curvature is not constant. Okay? And that, well, it just comes from Gauss-Bonnet. We normalize them to have equal area, and then we have that. And the proof is quite easy. So, we have to know what is we're using this formula, and then so we're just saying that the infimum of the curvature for if the curvature is constant and if we have two functions, integral of one function, integral of both are constant by Gauss-Bonnet, they both have equal sign, then the infimum of one of the constant guy, you can compare it to the infimum of, it will be bigger than the infimum of non-constant guy. So this is an extremely stupid observation, but true. Yeah. So in the regime where time is small, but what happens? For the sphere we get the round metric. In higher genus we get metric of constant curvature minus one in every conformal class. What happens when time is large? Well, now we look at the heat kernel. There is no constant term. So the term which decays the slowest of all terms is the term which corresponds to the first non-zero eigenvalue of the Laplacian, to lambda 1. Sometimes we call it spectral gap, right? The analog for large time is the following. So if you have two metrics such that the first eigenvalue of G naught is greater than the first eigenvalue of G one, then you have a similar inequality that you will have an inequality of two probabilities. And so if we are looking for extremal metrics for this probability for large time, then we would like to solve the following problem. So you take a surface, fix the area, and you want to find a metric which has the largest possible eigenvalue of the Laplacian, first non-zero eigenvalue of the Laplacian. Well, on the sphere, it's the round metric. That's an old result due to Hirsch. On the torus, the absolute minimum is kind of equilateral torus, right? So it's the torus you get from gluing to equilateral triangles. This is Yutani Dirashvili and other people. The saddle point is the square. On the but torus doesn't apply to the in this situation. But on the Klein bottle, you get a metric of revolution, but which is not flat. That's Dirashvili, Josip Polterovich, and myself. And so maybe a question to the audience. Can anyone guess what would be the answer in genus 2? So you fix the area which metric has the largest spectral gap among all metrics of that area. 1 minute. Okay, so. No, so that's the largest genus in which the solution is known, and here's the solution. The metrics which have large first eigenvalue, they kind of want to be round. But in higher genus, you cannot make the metric round and smooth, right? Because the integral of curvature has to be negative. But you can cheat. You can get ramified covers. So it's a double cover of the round sphere, but all the curvature is sitting at points at conical singularities. There are 6 of them. The angle at each is 4 pi. So ramification of index 2. And where you put them? Well, you can. Sort of the most obvious place, if you want to put 6 points on a sphere, put them at the coordinate axis at the vertices of an octahedron. It's not achieved. Right, it's not achieved. So this in fact, if you move these guys slightly, it will still be. So anyway, if you want the details, there's a paper in experimental math by 5 different people, myself, Madrash Fili, Polterovich, Mishlevitin, and Nili Manigam, where this thing is discussed. It's a conditional result, and the condition is that the first eigenvalue in some mixed Dirichlet-Neumann problem on some geodetic triangle on a round sphere should be bigger than 2. And numerically, it's 2.27, so we have a large safety margin, but anyway, so. Let me skip, in fact, if you want to compute the probability that curvature will change sign on a round sphere, you can use results due to Adler and Taylor about the excursion of Gaussian random fields, which are more precise than Borel TIS estimates. So you can get better estimates for this. The probability that curvature will change sign. But let me skip that. So let me let me look at what happens in dimension greater than 2, where the multiple in front of gradient squared of the scalar curvature does not vanish. So suppose dimension is at least 3, and then, so if you look at the new scalar curvature, then this is a vector whose components are Gaussian, but you look at the norm squared, and this is called Gaussian subordinated random field, and it's more difficult to find to get a good estimate on the large excursion probability of supremum being greater than A. So we have our results in that situation are weaker, and they look a little bit technical, so we can only get estimates from above, and they are probably not optimal. So the details are in the paper, which is announcement appeared in Electronic Research Announcements. The paper is an archive or on my webpage, whatever you prefer. We were doing, and then we were a little bit disappointed. And so we said, okay, so can we do anything interesting in higher dimensions? And the answer was yes, and you have to change the problem, as usual. And the problem we could do something about was to, instead of scalar curvature, we would study Q curvature. So let me very quickly tell you the story. So if you work in conformal geometry, and so if you start with the usual Laplacian and change the metric conformally, then the Laplacian of a new metric in dimensions 3 and above if you write the formula relating new Laplacian to the old Laplacian, it will have some gradient terms, right? So the question is, okay, can you look not at the Laplacian, but at some higher order elliptic operator, which will be Laplacian to some power, let's say. But can you do it in such a way that after a conformal change of metric, there will be no lower order terms? So the Laplacian in dimension 2 just gets multiplied by, you know, conformal factor to some power. Can you have the same thing happening in higher dimensions? And so the first person who wrote down this operator in dimension 4 was Panitz in unpublished manuscript. And then, so Pfefferman, Graham, many other people came up with various higher dimensional generalizations. So the four dimensional operator, let's see, it looks like Laplacian squared plus this expression, which is explicit. So scalar curvature times the original metric, 2/3 minus twice Ricci, and the whole thing delta is sandwiched between delta and d. Yeah. So delta is what star d star, right? Minus one, whatever. So such operators are called conformally covariant, and there exists such in even dimensions these operators are differential. In odd dimensions they are not differential. So I restrict myself to even dimensions. Life is a little bit nicer there. And you can have such operators, you know, the operator of largest order is, so let me make the precise statement. So suppose we have a compact reducible manifold of even dimensions, at least 4. We consider, so the conformally covariant elliptic operators of order n. So it looks like, Laplacian to the power dimension over 2, Laplacian is second order, so this is order n, plus lower order terms. It took a while to prove that these operators are self-adjoint. So the nice thing about them, that if you change the metric conformally, then they change like Laplacian does in dimension 2. So if you work in conformal geometry, the moral of the story is that this is a very convenient elliptic operator to work with. It has lower order terms, so it's not quite the Laplacian. So, but you know, this, if you have this formula, you can excuse many other shortcomings of this operator. So there exist lower order operators with similar properties, but we look just at Laplacian turn over 2. And then, okay, so then there was a nice formula. In dimension 2, we wrote down this formula for how Gauss curvature changes if the metric is changed conformally. Is there a formula in higher dimensions for these operators? Is there a kind of curvature which has kind of the same relationship with these operators as Gauss curvature does with two-dimensional Laplacian? The answer is yes. This is called Q curvature. And so again, in dimension 4, was, I guess, by Panitz or by Branson, I don't know. So in 4 dimensions, it's fairly explicit. In higher dimensions, I think the first explicit formula was probably written by Joule about a year ago, and it's fairly involved. If you want to write down this thing in dimension 16, it took many years to work out the explicit formula, but this thing is unique, and it plays an important role in conformal geometry. So there is a uniformization theorem, and the nice thing about this curvature is that if you change the metric conformally, then the new curvature is related to the old one by a formula which is very, very similar to the formula for Gauss curvature in dimension 2. And so now if you define your random metric using eigenfunction expansion in eigenfunctions of this conformal guy, then you can go ahead and develop the whole theory, which we did. Right. So now, well, let me, the last thing, just there are lots of questions you can ask. You know, we were working in the limit A goes to zero. Also, our metrics were smooth, but in quantum gravity, metrics that come up are much rougher. And from physics point of view, it would be very interesting to understand these things. But for such metrics, you know, people know what volume is, but they don't know what length is. So there is a bit of work to be done before we start playing the games we play here. Well, also in higher dimensions, you want to study Ricci n-sectional curvatures. Of course, that's much more interesting. But a single conformal multiple is just your control set. Control parameter is just too small. So you want to study metrics, you want to study all metrics, not just those in a conformal class, to really control other things like Ricci curvature. And then, well, sort of general hope is that there are all these wonderful conjectures in quantum chaos about properties of eigenvalues, eigenfunctions, whatever, and for a single metric, they're quite difficult to prove. And for some metrics, they actually are wrong. But for typical metrics, they're supposed to hold, and so the hope is that perhaps by introducing some Gauss measures, you know, like Villani and his talk said that, you know, most numbers are not rational, but to make a quantitative result, you need to look at the Lebesgue measure of the set of some badly approximable of numbers that can be approximated too well by rationals. So we're trying to do something similar, but for all Riemannian metrics. So it's a bit more difficult problem. So I hope that these type of techniques would be useful. Thank you very much.